The test is in four parts, part 1, part 2, part 3, and part 4. Now look at part 1.
Part 1.
John Helston, a student from London University, wants to know some information about a 21st conference. You'll hear a conversation between John and university staff. Now you have some time to look at questions 1 to 5. Listen carefully and answer questions 1 to 5.
University, good morning.
Oh, good morning. Can you put me through to the School of Architecture, please?
Certainly. School of Architecture, Professor Dawson's office.
Oh, good morning. I was wondering if you could give me some information about the forthcoming Architecture 21st Conference, dates, enrolment procedures, costs, that sort of thing.
Certainly.
When exactly is the conference?
Well, the conference runs for 3 days, from the 18th to the 20th of October.
18th to 20th of October? Oh, good. I'll still be here then. And where exactly is it being held? Is it at the university, as in previous years?
No, it's actually being held at the Pacific Hotel. We've rather outgrown the university conference facilities, so we've opted for this new venue.
Right, Paradise Hotel.
No, Pacific Hotel.
Oh, right. And presumably we can get accommodation at the hotel?
Yes, but you'll need to contact them direct to arrange that. I'll give you the number for hotel reservations. Have you got a pen ready?
Yeah, go ahead.
It's area code 07 and then 9333-2233.
Okay, and what's the registration fee?
Individual fees are $300 for the 3 days, or $120 a day if you only wanted to attend for 1 day.
Are there any student concessions?
Oh, sure. There's a 50% concession for students, and that's $150 for the 3 days, or $60 a day.
And am I too late to offer to give a talk?
Oh, I'm pretty sure you've missed the deadline for that.
Really? But I've only just arrived here in Australia. Is there any way I could have a paper accepted?
Well, you'd need to talk to Professor Dawson. He's the person organising the conference this year. I can put you through if you like.
Oh, yes, please. That'd be great. Oh, and can I just check the spelling of his name? Is that Dawson?
Yes, that's correct.
Before you hear the rest of the talk, you have some time to look at questions 5 to 10. Now listen carefully and answer questions 6 to 10.
Professor Dawson speaking.
Oh, hello. My name is John Helston. I'm an architecture student at London University. I'm here in Australia for 3 months, looking at energy-saving house designs.
Right.
I'm interested in giving a talk on my research at the conference, but I believe I may have missed the deadline.
Well, strictly speaking, you have. The closing date was last Friday.
Oh, no!
But we may be able to include your paper if it fits into our programme, but you'll have to be quick.
Okay. What do I need to do?
Send me an outline of your talk, and make sure you'd include an interesting title for the talk, something to attract the delegates' attention.
Okay, interesting title, right?
The outline should be no more than 300 words, though.
Right. I should be able to keep it down to 300 words, but would 400 be okay?
No, not really, because we have to print it in the proceedings, and we just don't have the space.
Sure, I understand.
And also, can you send me a short CV, the usual stuff, name, age, and qualifications, that sort of thing?
Right, include a brief CV.
Actually, you can email it to me. That'd be quicker.
Sure. What's your email address?
Well, the best thing would be to send it to the conference administrative officer. The address is admin in lowercase. You know, in small letters.
Right.
So that's admin at uniconf.edu.au.
Right. I'll do that straight away. Thank you very much. You've been very helpful.
Okay, well, we hope to see you in October then.
That is the end of part one.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now turns to part two.
Part two.
You will hear a lecture on bird migration.
First, you have some time to look at questions 11 to 17. Now, listen carefully and answer questions 11 to 17.
My lecture this evening will focus on the migration of birds. That is, how birds fly in big groups from different parts of the world at certain times of the year. In the first part of the lecture, I'll talk about the reasons why birds migrate, when they migrate, and which parts of the world they migrate from and to. To start with, why do birds migrate? Well, there are two main reasons. One, they migrate to look for food. And two, they travel to parts of the world that are more suitable for breeding. In fact, these reasons are closely linked. As you can imagine, when birds are breeding, they need extra food to feed their young. And in the spring, in the cooler climates of Europe, there is a lot of food for birds, especially insects. So generally, during the spring, birds fly up from the tropics, which are hot, to cooler climates in the north. They stay there for a few months to bring up their young. And then, when the weather in the north gets cold in the winter, they fly back to warmer climates in the south. Now I'd like to talk a bit about how global warming has affected bird migration. One of the effects of global warming has been to make the spring come earlier in the northern regions of the world. When spring comes early, the plants and insects that birds need to bring up their young are also available earlier. Research has shown that quite a lot of birds have started to migrate earlier because of higher temperatures. But unfortunately for some species, this hasn't been early enough. What I'm saying is that birds that are travelling a long way for breeding may arrive too late to find enough food to feed their young, and their population drops drastically. Scientists are currently researching more about this.
Before you hear the rest of the talk, you have some time to look at questions 18 to 20. Now listen and answer questions 18 to 20.
Now, I thought I'd finish by just briefly describing a few different patterns of migration. Migration varies with the type of bird and the area they come from. For example, one kind of migration is partial migration. This means that some birds in a particular species will migrate and others won't. It usually depends on how the weather affects food supplies, and very often happens in the tropics. In another migratory pattern, a bird called an Arctic tern migrates the whole length of the globe, from the North Pole to the South. The Arctic tern travels between 12 and 15,000 kilometres each way when it migrates in a complete circle around the world. It's quite amazing. Right, and lastly, I'd like to mention a pattern which isn't nearly as spectacular, but is very interesting. And this is the way many birds migrate across North America. In this pattern, the birds fly northwards in the west of the country and then back south again in the east. So, if you imagine it, they're actually migrating in a circular pattern, like the hands of a clock, not in a straight line, as we might think.
That is the end of part two.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now turns to part three.
Part three.
You will hear an interview with Dr. Simons.
First, you have some time to look at questions 21 to 24. Now, listen carefully and answer questions 21 to 24.
Well, as I said, there were three areas of interest, so perhaps we should take each in turn.
Fine. Let's take the medical and physical evidence first.
Well, first of all, life expectancy. Although some very old individuals were encountered, the Ramesses is a case in point. He was probably over 90. It seemed the average Egyptian died rather young, from about 30 to 35 years old, on the whole. Although the nobility, as might be expected, tended to live longer. Some of them have been found to be 50 or 60 years old. Well, naturally, the older they got, the more medical problems were encountered. But some modern disorders have so far not been found. There is no evidence yet of any malignant tumours, for example, although the fact that most people studied were comparatively young could account for this. Another modern problem, dental decay, was also absent, probably due to the plain diet and absence of sugar. There was another problem with teeth caused by this diet. The stones on which their flour was ground caused a lot of grit to get into the bread, and this eroded the teeth, so much that many older people must have suffered greatly and could have been confined to a liquid diet. An abscess on the jaw caused by this kind of erosion may in fact have contributed to the death of Ramesses II. Analysis of the internal organs of several mummies has revealed that intestinal parasites were common, even among the upper classes. Evidence of a generally low standard of public hygiene. And another widespread disorder was a form of anemia. Naturally, the ancient Egyptians didn't smoke, but lesions on the lung were widespread. These, however, are the sort that we associate today with workers in mines and quarries, and must be due, in the case of Egyptians, to living in sandy desert conditions. Actually, on the smoking issue, there was a temporary sensation when traces of what appeared to be tobacco were found in Ramesses' sarcophagus, but botanists later confirmed that it was not in fact tobacco itself, but a related plant which is native to Egypt. In the meantime, cynics were commenting that it probably had come from the cigarette of some careless Egyptologist or museum attendant of the past.
Ha ha! And what about their physical appearance? Before you hear the rest of the talk, you have some time to look at questions 25 to 30. Now listen and answer questions 25 to 30.
Well, what would you expect from seeing Egyptian art? They were light and slight in build. The average height for both men and women was about 1.60 meters, and studies of the skeletons from which the covering of flesh can be extrapolated suggest that they weighed much less in relation to their height than most modern people. From about 10 to 15 kilograms, less than someone of a similar height today is the estimate.
And what about mummification?
Well, the first thing to be said is that it wasn't always done in the same way, and it was by no means infallible, as many people tend to think. Many bodies, including that of the famous King Tutankhamun, were also entirely destroyed by overuse of one or another of the substances generally employed. The basic procedure was much the same, however. Most of the internal organs, including the brain, were removed and preserved separately in a jar. The brain was got out through the nose using a sort of hook.
Oh, dear.
Yes. It used to be thought that the heart was always removed too, but in the case of Ramesses, it was found in place. The body was then immersed in a substance called natron. That's a form of sodium carbonate, which occurred naturally in Egypt, for 40 to 70 days. It was then washed, made up and wrapped in linen bandages and placed in its coffin or sarcophagus. Then it was soaked in oils, resins and perfumes to help preserve it further.
You said the body was made up. Do you mean its face was painted?
Yes, yes. Ramesses was not only made up, they had to restructure his nose, which was damaged when they took out his brain. The investigators found that it had been stuffed with small animal bones and peppercorns, of all things. His hair had been dyed too.
You said that Ramesses had suffered other adventures after his death?
Ah, well, yes. Poor chap. Well, for a start, he was found in a much later tomb than his real date. Along with a lot of other pharaohs, it looks very much as if the priests of later times had moved and reburied him to save him from tomb robbers. His body was transported, along with the other pharaohs found in the same tomb, to the Cairo Museum. That was in 1871, and it was put on display. Well, naturally, removed from the dry desert atmosphere, his body started to deteriorate, and by the 1970s was in very poor state. That was part of the reason why the Egyptian authorities gave their consent for its temporary removal to Paris for study. Yet another upheaval. The French experts aimed not only to carry out an investigation, but were also able to apply the latest techniques of restoration and conservation, so that at the end of the study, Ramesses was specially treated and then rewrapped in new bandages. Well, they weren't exactly new, since they were of ancient Egyptian date. Given a new sarcophagus and carefully transported back to Cairo, where he is now kept in a controlled environment, which should slow down the deterioration process.
So, as I said at the beginning, not only was science served, but a proper respect was paid to the remains in the end.
Exactly.
That is the end of part 3.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now it turns to part four.
Part four.
You will hear a talk given by Dr. Miranda James. First, you have some time to look at questions 31 to 35. Now, listen carefully to the talk and answer questions 31 to 35.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the first in a series of talks we have arranged for the Overseas Students Association this semester. Dr. James has very kindly agreed to speak to us today on the topic of public speaking, and judging from the large numbers of you here, it's clearly a subject of great interest and relevance. Dr. James.
Hello. It's good to see so many of you here, and hopefully what I'm going to tell you will be useful to you both here at the university and in your future employment. Many people avoid speaking publicly, by which I mean in front of, say, 10 or more people, not because they lack the ability, but mainly because they lack confidence, which is really only due to lack of practice. Today, as a consequence of the influence of television, audiences expect speakers to be relatively brief and to the point, in addition to being well-informed and interesting or entertaining. Probably the most important part of public speaking is what you do beforehand, by which I mean preparation. This includes practical details, such as knowing precisely what your topic is and exactly how long you are expected to talk for. You should also plan the content thoroughly. A good strategy is to write out the content as you intend to say it, and then make brief notes, preferably on small cards, which you use to talk from. This way you sound more natural. You incorporate pauses while you look at your notes, and you can then look at your audience while you are speaking. Never read your speech without looking at the audience. Eye contact is a very important part of communicating with an audience. So deliberately move your head and look around at your audience. Pauses are important, as most people, when they are nervous, tend to rush through their speech.
Now you have some time to look at questions 36 to 40. Now listen and answer questions 36 to 40.
Practice speaking slowly. This gives you more time to pronounce your words correctly. It's always easier for your audience to listen to someone whose speaking is clear and calmly paced, so that they can understand the ideas being explained. And the bigger the group, the more slowly you should speak. Remember to project your voice, speaking clearly to the person furthest away from you. It's a good idea to rehearse and record yourself. Pay attention to your intonation when you listen to yourself. It's even harder if you're speaking in a second language, I would imagine. But there's nothing worse than listening to a flat, monotonous voice. So try to vary your tone and rhythm. This will add meaning to your words. Lastly, pay attention to both your posture and your gestures. A confident person stands or sits in a small group with their head up, chin out, and shoulders back. Try to avoid scratching or fiddling with your hair or beard, or pens, jewellery, and so on. These movements can distract and irritate your audience. Yet you may be unaware of them yourself. Another reason for rehearsing, preferably with feedback from a friend, or better still, on video. I hope these few tips will make your experience of speaking in public a little easier. Remember, practice makes perfect.